Good morning. Welcome to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Today is Thursday, the 9th day of March, 2006. It's now 8:35 a.m. Have Senator French, Senator Guest, Senator Huggins, myself, Senator Seekins. Senator Terrio is in Washington, D.C. at the Energy Conference. And we have a couple of items on the agenda this morning. First, we have a Mr. William Granger before us, looking at interviewing him for confirmation to the Alaska State as Board of Governors of the Alaska Bar. Mr. Granger, are you here?
Good morning.
Good morning, sir. If Mr. Granger, welcome to the Senate Judiciary Committee. And if you'll put your name on the record for us, we'd like to just have a little conversation with you about why it is that you're looking to fill this slot, sir.
Certainly. Good morning. My name is William A. Granger. I reside in Anchorage. This is a reappointment to the Board of Governors, I have found the work by the Board of Governors to be an important attribute to not only the bar at large, but also our community. I think they fill a very important role in maintaining the quality of our judicial system and the lawyers that practice in it.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Granger this morning? Senator French?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I'll jump in. Good morning, Mr. Granger. It's Hollis French here in Juneau. I'm looking at the function of the Board of Governors, and it says governs Alaska Bar, administers bar exam, and so forth. Does the Board of Governors set the bar dues? Do you know?
Board of Governors does set the bar dues.
And do you know where our bar dues rank nationally as far as whether we're at the high end of the bar dues, low end of the bar dues, or in the middle?
We're on the high end of the bar dues.
And have you, or has it ever been raised within your time on the Board of Governors, or have you contemplated raising the idea that maybe there should be a two-tiered system for practitioners in the public service arena? I'll just speak for my experience, which was, you know, I went to work as a clerk for a Superior Court judge, which doesn't pay that much. Then I went to work in the Anchorage DA's office that doesn't pay that much. And I was fairly fortunate in that I didn't have large law school loan payments to make. I'd finance that out of pocket. But I know a lot of my colleagues did. And, you know, the bar dues, which are now, I think, $550 a year, that's a pretty healthy bite out of a young public service-oriented sort of person's budget. Have you ever thought about doing a public service bar dues category for public defenders, prosecutors, and other folks who sort of don't take the more moneyed approach to practice the law?
Actually, bar dues are probably one of the more hotly discussed and consistently discussed topics of the bar Board of Governors. And they have, in fact, initiated some public service types of reduced bar dues, or I believe even non-existent in some cases, for those people who offer large amounts of pro bono work, etc. You know, as far as no bar dues for public service type folks, I mean, do receive benefit from belonging to the bar. That benefit comes in forms such as continuing education opportunities, you know, networking with other lawyers during those opportunities, the duty of participating and assisting in the managing of the participants in their line of work is also considered, at least in my mind. You know, I think everybody has some obligation to participate in their profession and support it.
Mr. Granger, I couldn't agree more. I guess And I won't belabor that. I'm sure the committee's interested in this. Isn't nearly as great as mine, and so I don't want to spend too much time on this. But, you know, it just occurs to me that, you know, some folks go to work for a private law firm, and they're going to soon be making, you know, upwards of $100,000 a year, and some folks go to work at the DA's office where they will never make that money, or if they do, they'll make it after 20 years of service. And it just strikes me that you could easily have a two-tiered system where you say, you know, for those of you who are making the choice to serve the public in that manner, we're going to give you a little break on your bar dues because we recognize that you're not making the kind of money that the higher end of the profession makes.
Well, I mean, you know, you're assuming that everyone in private practice knocks down the big bucks. You know, that is not true at all. I mean, there are a lot of starving young lawyers out there. There are a lot of, in my opinion, also being a banker, seeing a lot of financial statements, I can tell you that, you know, most lawyers are pretty common, middle-class, ordinary people. You know, they don't make big bucks. So I don't know that just because a person works for the state and receives state benefits and, you know, is supposedly being compensated fairly for their work by the state, et cetera, should receive some extra benefits that somebody who's working in the private sector making the same amount of money doesn't get. But I hear what you're saying, okay, and I'm sensitive to it, and I think that there are folks who provide tremendous public service out there for very little compensation in the area of doing pro bono work who deserve a break, and we're trying to give it to them.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Gass.
Yes, thank you, and thank you for your willingness to serve. Can you talk a little bit about how you and how the board approach disciplinary action? One of the critiques I've heard, and I don't know if it's a critique of this group, I think it is that someone will lodge a complaint against an attorney and it takes years, if ever, for the Bar Association to actually get to it and resolve it. And I don't know if that's true or not, but I would be interested in just a brief explanation of the, you know, how many cases and what's the length of from complaint to resolution, and also how you approach disciplinary action of attorneys.
I do not have any exact numbers for you. I can tell you that the current number of cases that are being investigated and looked after by the staff of the Bar Association is less than it has historically been. So they're on the down side of the cycle. I can also tell you the Board of Governors has been very active, more so recently than in the past, as to looking at the management of those cases and how long it takes for resolution to occur. The nature of the case generally determines the length of time that it's going to take. In some cases, you are correct, it can take years. It is process, is very similar to any other due process type of system. You know, there's a complaint, there's an investigation, there's an initial determination made, there's a letter written, there's a time for response, there's back and forth. It's very much like filing a lawsuit and waiting for an answer and getting an extension and waiting for another determination and then doing more investigation. And it seems like a very simple process, but when you include, you know, the rights of all parties involved and their right to have a time to think about it and respond and even have counsel, it can take, you know, 18 months to 2 years to just kind of normally run something through the system if it is a chargeable or serious type thing, and that's just the way it is. A lot of this is dictated by the court system that the Bar or Board of Governors really has no control over at all. So, you know, and we can make a determination, and all we do is just make a recommendation. We don't do anything other than that. It's actually the court who does something. And, you know, they can take 6 months to decide that, you know, maybe they didn't like a piece of it and they could remand it back to us. and it might take us 8 months to get it back to them again. Not because we're sitting on our thumbs, but because that's part of the problem. It is an aggravating, slow process, but one which the Board of Governors is currently actively seeking ways of streamlining, and I'd like to think that we've made some progress here in the last year. I hope that answers your question.
Part of it. Thank you.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah. Thank you. Mr. Granger, Charlie Huggins here from Meadow Lakes, right outside of Wasilla. My question for you has to do, you have been on the board for how long?
6 years.
6 years. In that time frame, could you characterize for us if there has been any evolution in the process as you knew it when you got there, and 6 years later, there's been improvements?
You know, I was thinking somebody was probably going to ask me that, but I kind of looked at it as, okay, you've been here 6 years, what have you done? So the first 3 years, you just kind of, it takes that long just to figure out what's going on. And then it takes a while after that to kind of sort out the fact from the fiction and what can be done with what you have to work with. I don't know that there's been evolution so much as there are changes in dynamics in the makeup of the board.
Yeah.
There are people sitting on the board that have certain subjects that they're interested in, and that makes things happen. And when those people rotate off the board, those subjects go away. But you know, it is a very well managed machine, I believe. I think the association does a good job of management of it, not just the discipline part of it, but the continuing education part of it, the admittance part of it. You know, every meeting we have our mission statement in front of us, and it's reviewed, and you know, we try to just keep to the point here.
Right. In that respect, could you just characterize for us what value added you bring to the table? What you see in yourself?
I think I add a common street commercial sense to what's going on. You know, with all due respect, recognizing most our lawmakers or lawyers, you know, you're sitting in a room with 12 lawyers, and you know, it's really hard to get something done when you have 12 lawyers. And to keep them on task or on point, to not over lawyer something, or you know, making sure that everybody has their own little spin or mark on it, to keep the ball moving, I think, and to add a practical aspect to it is what the public members do, and I like to think I contribute to that.
Right. And finally, if you could name three tasks that are critical that the board performs, what would they be?
Certainly, discipline is a critical task. Oversight of the management of the association in a broad sense is pretty critical, and liaison between the public and the bar itself is a pretty critical aspect. You know, the public counts on the Bar Association to listen to them, voice their opinions about what's going on with our legal system. Yeah, and we take that to heart, and you know, make proposals to the court for new rules and all kinds of things.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Granger.
Mr. Granger, Senator Seekins, we're actually at, we're way overpopulated with attorneys in the Senate. I think we're up to two.
Yeah, I knew there were.
How many members are there in the association?
Boy, you know, I think there's a couple of thousand. Not all of them are active, and not all of them are in state. But yeah, I think there's a couple thousand.
So you're bringing in $1 million a year in dues?
I don't have our budget right here in front of us, but I think it's probably more on the line. I think our gross revenues are probably $1.7 million or $1.8 million. I'm just pulling that number out of my
And what does the association do with those dues?
That would be more than just dues. That would be, continuing education fees.
Right.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of things that are done with the dues. Administering admittance is an expensive deal. The major part of our expense, however, is in the area of discipline, investigation, and things like that. But continuing education, administering the admittance, those are right up there.
Okay. How often does the Bar Board of Governors meet?
The Board of Governors meets every other month.
And
sometimes more often if you're on a committee or group, you'll meet more often.
So there's some time commitment there for you as well.
Actually, the meetings are 2 days long, and they are a significant time commitment. Now, those meetings generally are held in Anchorage. The only time you wouldn't have them, which is where the bulk of the board is, the only time they wouldn't be here is if you had a out-of-town bar convention, which happens, would rotate it between Southeast and Fairbanks, so every third year here.
Okay. Do they give you an honorarium or fee to be on the Board of Governors?
No, I do receive a slam sandwich.
Yeah, slam sandwich?
Per diem, I think.
Per diem?
No, I receive nothing.
Okay.
That's not what it's
And I've historically paid my own travel expenses and hotel expenses as well.
All right. Senator French?
Not that they wouldn't pay it.
Right. I understand. Senator French?
This is just a follow-up on a question that Senator Seekins asked, Mr. Granger, about the continuing education. You know, you charge, those are four-fee classes to keep you up to date on evidence or negotiation or what's happening in the federal bar or what's happening in the Court of Appeals. So there's a fee for those. Do those pay their own way or are those subsidized through the dues?
Some are subsidized through the dues, and some pay their own way, some more than pay their own way. There are a lot of opportunities that are also free. Just participating in a section committee, for example, on a particular topic, say bankruptcy, for example, just attending that, and whether you choose to buy lunch or not, doesn't make any difference. That's as a continuing education point, if you will. So it depends on the attendance. We may not determine the level of interest correctly, and it might cost us a few $100 to put something on, or we might make a few $100. It's not necessarily looked at as a source of revenue, but we try not to lose money doing it as well.
Thank you.
And Mr. Granger, some of these questions may not necessarily be relative to your recommendation by the members, but this committee has a habit of taking a look at the organizations as well and looking at not just the appointments but to the added benefit to the people of the state of Alaska for some of the organizations and what they do in relationship to our mission here in the Judiciary Committee. So any other questions for Mr. Granger? Seeing none, I have before me a letter that would be addressed to President of the Senate that says, in accordance with AS 3905-080, the Senate Judiciary Committee reviewed the following and recommends the appointment be forwarded to the Senate floor or a joint session, whichever applies for consideration. Board of Governors of the Alaska Bar, William A. Granger. This does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against the individual during any further session. That letter is before me. And the chair would entertain a motion.
Chairman, I'll also move.
The Senator French has moved to forward this letter to the President of the Senate. Is there objection? Hearing none, Thank you, Mr. Granger, for your time this morning. We do appreciate your willingness to serve the state of Alaska in this capacity, and we'll take just a short recess here in the committee.
Thank you.
You bet.
Senate Judiciary will come back to order. The chair has gone to another committee, and what we'll do today essentially is take public testimony, and then based on whether the chair returns or not, we probably will adjourn to call the chair and continue from there based on timing. Okay, with that, I see we have Wynn Minifrey. Wynn, are you there?
I am.
Okay.
I'm available to answer questions.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay. And Mr. John Baker?
He's hung up. He's disconnected. He may call back.
Okay. All right, Mr. Baker may call back in from Department of Law. We will now go to Anchorage to Mr. Peter Putzier. Peter, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes. Would you please put yourself on the record and whom you're affiliated with, and we will hear your testimony.
Peter Putzier, I'm with the Department of Law, and I'm just available for questions.
Okay, and let me just interject. We're we're taking testimony on House Bill 318. Excuse me, we're not pitching that. Okay, Mr. Ed Earnhardt?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, Ed, put yourself on the record, please.
Surely. I'm Ed Earnhardt, and I am here on behalf of what I call the public. I'm a activist in local government and politics, and I have a background of knowledge about small cities and big cities. Chairman Huckins and the Senate Judiciary Committee members, House Bill 318 usurps what is properly the authority of local governments by foreclosing them from using eminent domain related to economic and quality of life developments. I say quality of life developments instead of recreation. It robs them of the leverage to achieve fair settlements with recalcitrant property holders. It is true that an eminent domain has been inappropriately or even illegally applied in some cases, but the abuses of the power are exaggerated, and it is hard to measure the many cases of public goods it has served and is needed to help in the future. But after many years of its application, especially in urban renewals, condemnation of property in poor areas, what we used to call slums, rundown areas, and cesspools of iniquity like the combat area zone of central Boston, the time for reaction was ripe by anti-government and complete laissez-faire forces to jump in and turn us back. A case involving condemnation of a few middle-class houses. They talk about poor people. These people were not poor that owned those houses there in New London. With long-time residents was ideal for focusing on to scare people. And you know how the United States is today. Scare is being used all the time. Many were propagandized, and the liberal press failed in its reporting to bring any balance on the issue. So this has taken the country. And and we've joined the thundering herd. Grover Norquist and his ilk were able to show that they really cared about the little guy. Yeah. In this case, 10 residents and 5 speculative lots were the ones that were tied up. The state of Connecticut had laws that allowed a transaction for economic development, which allowed the exercise of eminent domain, even when it might involve turning land over to corporation and private developer to achieve the aims to improve the city and its economy. This was a prime development with many facets to it. The report of your staff seemed to have picked up the propaganda verbatim in some cases of the attackers of taxation and the authority of communities in response to its people versus extreme views of private rights they consider conservative. In consideration of the rightful and responsible authority of local governments, House Bill 318 is an abomination. Finding in some cases is hobbled. It puts a public person in jeopardy of legal extortion by realty and developer interests. Sure, zoning is used to protect communities and accomplish improved development, but when dire need hits and deterioration has taken place in both the human and natural habitat, government needs to be able to deal with it. Recreational opportunities and economic development may be engineered by public and private cooperation, and is. Eminent domain should seldom be used, but in fact it can be used as an important tool for government. I know how much work you have done in House Bill 318, but firmly believe it is misguided, as the majority of people I've talked to about it, except some members of the Anchorage Municipal Assembly, who race to get ahead of you on the issue. They had various reasons, those members of the Assembly, of which many you are aware. The folly should not be yours. I already that's about what I want to say, that I think that maybe what we have had could be improved upon, but basically this what Representative McGuire referred to as a minor thing is not. It's a big thing in many cases, and especially as we look to the future. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Earnhardt. Are there questions for Mr. Earnhardt? Mr. Earnhardt, let me make sure on behalf of the committee that we have clear your position. Is it you do not want limits on eminent domain?
Oh, I didn't say I didn't want limits on it. I don't want the kind of limits you have set up in that bill that passed the House.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Earnhardt.
Can I just follow up on that?
Yeah. Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Earnhardt, is your objection more to the there's two sort of main provisions in the bill.
Sure.
One provision would prevent the use of eminent domain to transfer property, from one private party to another for economic development. And the other part of the bill is to prohibit the use of eminent domain where the taking is for a recreational facility or project, including a park, trail, or and so forth. Are you adamantly opposed to both those, just one, or if one, which one?
Well, unless it's qualified, I'm opposed to both of them. As I said before, I would prefer some other word used, like quality of life, for parks and what have you, as opposed to give sheer recreation. Much of this is more than recreation.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Earnhardt. Mr. Earnhardt, sound like you were reading your testimony. Could you send us a copy of that?
Oh, yeah, I will.
Okay, good. Thank you very much. And we certainly appreciate your coming out and making your thoughts known to us. Thank you very much for that. We will now go to Juno Hope Surmelt. Is that Hope, please? Yeah, Hope, if you just put yourself on the record and
good morning. Thank you for this time to share. Hope Surmel, I'm from Fairbanks, Alaska, staying here in Juneau, learning about how the process works here at the state capitol. My testimony is one of owning a real estate license in the state of Arizona for 28 years. It's a very sad state of affairs when the state of Alaska has to get into eminent domain. I do believe that the one comment and statement that's made here about the cities and municipalities, I do believe each one should have in their own rules and regulations a way to take care of this, that the state really shouldn't enter in the affairs of this kind of process. It's a serious thing because some people do lose their homes, their livelihood, and it just was a very interesting bill that came out this way. Again, my major statement is it's sad when the state of Alaska has to get into eminent domain. Thank you.
Yeah, quick questions for Hope, when you look at this House bill, are there any specific provisions that you object to, or is it just the fact that you prefer local control?
I myself feel that it should be the city or municipalities or even the borough's job to do this kind of it's seriously a power, and it therefore goes into the state of Alaska through this bill that needs to be enacted. Talked to two people outside and they said it was a good thing to do. It's just a scary thing when the state gets into this kind of business.
Okay. Other questions for Ms. Surmelt? Well, thank you very much coming to us from Fairbanks. And next we have Ruth Blackwell. Ruth? Glad you could join us today, Ruth. And you are from Juneau.
I am from Juneau. I'm with Powell Realty in Juneau. I'm here representing the Alaska
Ruth,
Association.
Ruth, what's your full name?
Oh, Ruth Blackwell, Juneau, Alaska. I'm here representing the Alaska Association of Realtors. And as Mr. Johnson said last week, some of us are 90% happy with the bill. We're more 95% happy with the bill. We agree that this will correct the Kelo case. It will make people more secure in their personal residence. They don't have to worry that someone bigger and bolder can come in and take their home for economic development. We're happy that the definitions are in the bill, public use, residential, and economic development. That way the courts won't tend to decide what we all thought in the beginning of this. So we're very happy about that. The 95% that we are is that we kind of would like no net loss. We would like to see that if something, we have 1% of our land mass in Alaska is in private ownership. There's 1% that's being taxed, moving through the system. You know, when there's a buy and there's a sell and everything, there's an economic drive. We would really like to see that the recreational land is taken out of the other 99% of our mass, rather than out of what is in private ownership. That would just be our preference. But we're happy with what we have. Some other day we can discuss that. But other than that, we are glad that the personal residence will not be affected.
Yep.
Any question?
Thank you, Ruth, for your testimony. I understand the no net loss on the recreational. It could be the case, though, that you could have on the economic development side also a loss off the tax roll. So is it because it could go to a not-for-profit for economic reasons? Right. And so that would have the same
effect.
The same effect. So is it your all's contention that in any case where when we're taking property off tax rolls, we should have a no net loss, kind of as a general?
Well, I think that's kind of the utopia we would love,
okay,
but it's not reality.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean,
I just wanted to make sure that it was on both parts of the bill.
Yes, exactly. It's just not reality at this point in time. But our main focus is on personal residences, you know, home ownership, business. I mean that's the foundation that is in our industry, and so we feel that people should be secure in their homes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good, thank you. Senator French? Yeah, Ruth, the 5%, you mentioned a couple, are there any other things in the 5% that
we'll always be back another day.
Yeah. Well, number one, thank you very much for coming and us hearing your testimony. You know, it's always important, I think, for each of us in the process. I mean, you represent a commercial entity, but I think in listening to you really present a persona of the average Alaskan in the respect that they understand that what we're trying to do here is to keep their government out of their life overbearingly, and unfortunately all of us have witnessed some of the things that's happened in other states and are frightened by that. And you know, it's our intention, and I think this bill, but some of its intention, that we put up a roadblock for those kind of intrusions into life. And so I'm happy with 318, what it represents in the macro, and we certainly appreciate your coming out today. Thank you. Mr. Kevin Ritchie.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Huggins and Committee. My name is Kevin Ritchie with the Alaska Municipal League, and the first thing I'd like to say right off the bat is that the Alaska Municipal League does not have a policy, never has had, either in support or against eminent domain, and our testimony is not centering on eminent domain. You know, in terms of what the Municipal League is about is really allowing people in communities to continue to make choices about the betterment of their communities. In fact, three of our largest communities have already adopted ordinances fairly similar to this bill, and that's plays out as it should in communities, you know, making decisions about what's right for their individual community. My only comment is there really is no need under the Constitution or under the concept of people and communities making their own decisions to include municipalities in the bill. And the point that I'd like to make is that the legislature obviously could always change anything that it does. You know, it has the power, obviously, to change statutes. The intent of the bill, as stated right at the beginning, says that the legislature intends by this act not to provide an absolute bar on transfers of land to private entities, but to place restrictions on such transfers when they occur, which it does, in fact, for the state of Alaska. But for communities, if this bill overrides their authority and they don't have the statutory power to come back to the legislature and change this, then it is pretty much an absolute, it's not necessarily fulfilling the intent of the bill. So we'd be happy to work with you on any language or changes you might be interested in making. But again, absolutely no criticism of whether eminent domain is good or bad. Three of our largest communities, Anchorage, Fairbanks Borough, Kenai Peninsula Borough, have already adopted ordinances similar to this. I'm not sure how similar, but very similar, possibly more restrictive in some cases. But again, that's the local community, people closest to the issue, defining for their own neighbors what's the best way to go. So thank you very much for allowing me to testify.
Yeah. Good questions for Ms. Ritchie. Yes. Senator Guest.
Thank you. Kevin, am I interpreting your testimony correct that we don't, in your mind, need sections 4 and 5 of the bill?
Through the chair, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator French, do you have questions about your news?
No, thank you.
Okay. Kevin, in the respect of your large organizations, you mentioned three of your members. Are there other geographical areas that or individuals that have shown some concern with this bill that might be germane for us to hear that you think is important?
Mr. Chairman, that's you're asking if have any other jurisdictions passed ordinances similar to
No, that have concerns with House Bill 318.
From a local control issue, each year the Alaska Municipal League gets together once a year in its entire membership and has a membership meeting and sets its top priorities. This year, of course, you probably already know that revenue sharing and PERS are two top issues. The third issue is local control, and the fourth issue is education funding. So local control in its broad sense is very important to all municipalities, and maintaining that balance of allowing people in communities to continue to be able to make decisions that affect the lives of themselves and their neighbors, in areas of taxation, local powers, and so on. And in regard to this particular issue, I don't know of any. If the question was if there are other communities that have dealt with this issue, I'm not sure that any of the larger communities have already dealt with the issue, but a number have, and
right.
It's an issue everywhere, I think.
Right. Yeah. In that respect, I mean, I can only speak from constituents that I've heard from in Mat-Su that the provisions in 318 in this case are in line, generally speaking, with the philosophy of the average person that lives in Mat-Su. I mean, there certainly could be some exceptions, and that if the Mat-Su borough was going to do anything, they would reinforce this maybe with potentially more stringent or expansion, but not much exception to it. But do you think that from your organization, do you think that's an accurate statement?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And again, my only point isn't about eminent domain, but simply the local
control. No, and that's a good one.
Yeah.
That's a good one. But on the other hand, as you know, I mean, I think many of us were surprised at some of the things that happened across the nation that sort of sounded the alarm bell, if you will, in the minds of average Alaskans. And unfortunately, sometimes there's a rush to fix that at multi-echelon levels, and that's not all bad. That's not all bad. So, and this is one of those attempts, and quite frankly, I think is a pretty rational approach to it. And of course, we got our jobs to flesh that out, and we thank you very much for helping us do that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chairman, one suggestion that I might ask you to consider, you know, I mean, the local control issue obviously is important, and I totally concur with your estimate of the average person. I've experienced that as well and thought about that as well. A number of our communities have, and this is a topic of discussion. The suggestion of even modifying this bill essentially to provide some measure of communities in the future to come back in some manner if there is a change of policy or whatever, to not have the legislature overriding local control when itself obviously has its own state control. It can still make changes or modifications to a bill if it desires to. And the provision that is left out of the municipal side, I guess, is number 7. The legislature has approved by law the transfer of property. That's on page 4, line 9. You know, simply one option might be simply allowing something similar to that for local governments, or at least some way of modifying a law or provision that may in the future not be in the best interest of a particular community. So with that, I just want to thank you very much for your consideration. We'd be happy to work with you if you'd like us to.
Okay. And you will remain available as we work through this, and we certainly appreciate that. You're here locally.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay, good.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. Are there additional questions for Mr. Ritchie?
No.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Are there other people here in the audience that would like to speak today? Craig, would you like to come up and just give you an opportunity if there are some things that, based on our previous hearings, that you needed to clear up?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Craig Johnson, staff to Representative McGuire. I don't think there's a lot I need to clear up, because I think this is a process that is ongoing and continuing, and certainly not our last opportunity to visit.
Okay.
What I will say is that I don't know that I disagree with anything I've heard.
Okay.
There are opportunities. The sponsor is very, very much believes that it is the responsibility of the state to make this decision.
Right.
Eminent domain flows from the Constitution through the state to the cities, and boroughs and organized. So it is our responsibility. It is a policy call. And as an overall statement, as long as the two policy issues that we address, the private-to-private transfer and the protecting people's homes for recreational purposes, as long as those two basic premises and basic policy decisions we work within those premises, we're not going to have any problems with anything that strengthens, in the opinion of this committee, those goals. So we're not, as you see by the co-sponsors, we have 21 co-sponsors. They didn't all come at once. They came with their two cents worth, and once it was added, people were able to sign on to it, because this has been a living piece of legislation. I expect it to live on in the Senate. So, and that's really all I have to say. So amendments are welcome. They're certainly, we haven't created the perfect mousetrap. Hopefully we can create good policy when we're done and get it out of the body.
Okay. Senator Guess.
Thank you. Thank you, Craig. Especially for your openness of comments. You had said that the sponsor believes it flows from the Constitution to the state. Is it her contention that we have the responsibility deciding if it's a state or local issue, or we have the responsibility to determining eminent domain in the state?
I think probably both. There are certain issues that should be made locally in a zoning manner, but in those two overriding policies, that it is a clear policy that the private transfer and that a person's home should be protected is a policy that should come from the state. So I think in some areas it would be local, in some areas it wouldn't. So I don't.
But the state could decide that it's a local issue.
Certainly.
That's a valid policy.
Certainly, absolutely.
Okay, just want to make sure. And can you do we have time for a few questions on the bill? Can you talk a little bit about how the 200 linear feet was determined?
Yes, ma'am, Senator Guest. That started out as.
Point of order. It's 250. 250.
250 linear feet.
Yes.
What did I say? I'm sorry.
200.
Oh, sorry. 250 linear feet. Page 4, line 13.
The original draft of the bill was 1,000 feet, and that was kind of put in as a placeholder because we weren't really sure, and we haven't really taken testimony from people. As we start working with the different user groups. That represents about 4.5 acres. Senator Huggins said, if you put your house in a football field, that's about the area that would be protected if you put in the end zone and then drew a circle around end zone to end zone. We looked at a number of opportunities. 1,000 feet would be about 80 acres, or 40 acres. That's a huge piece of land. The Department of Natural Resources has some difficulty with that. We saw some problems with potential projects being blocked, possibly by someone going out and saying, this is my home and you can't take this. If you have an unlimited piece of property that your home's on, you could have a guide say, my property's 10,000 acres, I live on it, you can't take any of it. This is part of that balance that we talked about. It allows, as guaranteed by the Constitution, the ability to almost in every instance we could come up with, that size property would allow someone to go around as opposed to go through someone's primary residence. And if you're out in a wilderness situation where you have an opportunity to need access, it's bigger than most city lots. So it was kind of a mix of urban and rural needs for access to resources out in some of the more rural areas. Yet still able to protect the rural lifestyle with a fairly sizable piece of land, but not an extraordinarily large. So it's a balance, and there's nothing magic about it. The talk shows the last 2 days in Anchorage have been blasting this bill because it's too small a piece of land. They think that you shouldn't be able to take any property for recreational purposes. So we're getting heat from the far right talk shows because we're not protecting enough of a piece of someone's land. That's at 90%. So, it's a balance. There's nothing magic about it. It could be 300, it could be 200, but that's where it's come at this point. That's the living document that we're working with today.
All right. Thank you. May I continue?
Yes.
At this point, or maybe in a future hearing, could you respond to AML's concern that we don't need Section 4 and 5 of the bill? I don't know if you could do that now of why we have that in, or maybe at a future meeting.
I can start it now, Senator. It's basically from that policy that eminent domain is the responsibility of the state. Not everyone is in prior testimony, and I don't want to put words into the municipal league, but they came forward with an amendment which would have additional restrictions, which would make it harder to do, which would require a vote, and quite honestly, the sponsors. Feeling was that why aren't you doing that now? Eminent domain has, as cities come and go, and as administrations come and go, philosophies of eminent domain change. This is an attempt for a clear cut state policy. In terms of what Mr. Ritchie said about giving the municipalities the same out as in number 7 there, I don't think that if the municipalities were to come and ask for an amendment saying a vote of the people in these cases, that it would be put on a ballot and the people would be allowed to choose, very much like the legislature would be allowed to override certain aspects of this bill, I don't think the sponsor would have any problem with putting it on a ballot and giving them the ability to put it on a ballot and vote and do eminent domain that way. So I don't think we would have a lot of difficulty granting that particular aspect of it. It would have to be a substantial threshold, though. I don't think it would be just, you know, the Department of Administration saying it's okay. It would need to be a more well thought out process. An election being the one that comes to mind.
Okay. Senator French.
Thank you. thanks for being here. Back to the, and I appreciate the balancing act you're performing. It's a tough one. Going back to the 250 feet, I just sketched a rough drawing. It's rough. But the drawing, if you can see it, it has two situations. On the lower end, there's a homeowner who's going to lose a little piece of his property to a trail. And on the upper, there's two homeowners involved, or two landowners involved, one with a home on it. That's the little box. And on the upper drawing, you see you're going to lose a little piece of your land. A is going to lose a little piece of his land to a trail, but B would have no complaint about that because it's not his property. That's the way the bill works, right? You could grab a little piece of A's land for a trail, and B would have no complaint, even if he's 100 feet away, because it's not his property, it's being grabbed. That's the way I understand your bill. Is that right?
Senator French, yes, sir. And we would hesitate to give someone right over another person's property in any case.
But B could be affected by this. If this is, and these are these little up and down lines, this indicates a flat and level piece of property. So there's B sitting here and looking out, and suddenly there's going to be a trail right in his view, but not on his property. So that's it could be just 100 feet away, but because it's not his property getting grabbed, he's got no protection from this bill. That's the way I understand it. And this lower drawing has A just as far away, but he owns this property. But in this case, see these little up and down lines? That's an impenetrable bluff. It's just a natural sort of part of the land that blocks any view that he could possibly have, and yet you're grabbing a little piece of property down there, and he would be able to stop that because it's being taken for a trail. And so I guess the point of my little drawing and question is to ask whether you've considered sort of taking into account the lay of the land and using that, and I'm sure it's come up at some point, and it's much more difficult to administer, I'd be the first to admit, than to say just a cut and dry 250 feet. But I wonder if you've thought about using, you know, sort of design standards or some kind of more contextual approach to the problem, so you could protect, you know, in the upper situation, you could protect B. You could say, you know what, this just isn't going to work here because it ruins, you know, there could be a whole bunch of bees up here that are going to ruin, and they're going to lose too much, you know, in that situation. Whereas in the lower situation, most people would say, you know what, A's never going to notice that, you know, a little strip of ground going off the end of his property because there's, you know, there's 500 spruce trees there, or there's, you know, if it's a boulder hedge or whatever it is, he'll just never see that. So I, you know, it's I know it's a little bit implausible, the question, but we've got time to burn, and so I thought I'd ask it.
Senator French, I guess I could tap dance, but no, sir. That, you know, I think everything has been considered at one point or another. There's practical matters of legislation, and sometimes we don't want to sacrifice the good for the perfect in every case. What I think 318 represents is a very good public policy. Is it perfect? Certainly not. Could I draw 100 little things like that that would say, well, what ifs, that would be make perfect sense? Absolutely. As could anyone. The balancing act, I go back to that. We're trying to establish a policy for the state. There are circumstances. I don't think this committee wants to be meeting in people's backyards at some point saying, yeah, this is a good place to build a trail. No, it's not. So the practicality, and nor does a municipality, or nor does any, you know, they have Department of Transportation people that do that. So no, that, I think, that, you know, I hate the term slippery slope, but I think once you start, you know, micromanaging any more than we are, I think it would be difficult. So that level of control has not been talked about, but it is a valid concern. But once again, it's a balance, and it's the not sacrificing the good for the perfect.
On a slightly different topic, thank you for that answer. On page 5, I keep coming back in recreation, the definition of recreational facility or project.
5, subsection B, lines 7 through 10, you've got the sort of the broad outline of, or list of those types of developments or projects that would fall under the heading of recreational facility or project and would not be allowed under, under this bill if we were to pass it. And I guess as I look at that, I can see, you know, I've been thinking about how irritated I would be if the state came along and said, you know, we're going to grab part of your backyard to run a bike trail through here because we just got to have it. We just, you know, it's just a great way to get kids to the ball fields is through your backyard. And that would irritate me. I don't have a huge backyard. It's, you know, it's my little backyard, and I like it just the way it is. I guess I'm at some personal level in agreement with the park, trail, pedestrian pathway, green belt listed on line 7. But then on line 8, we get into amusement parks, and I have no use for amusement parks, so you can leave them in there as far as I'm concerned. But small boat harbors and sports facilities, those are the two that sort of jump out at me as maybe not kind of going with the other ones. And I'm just expressing a concern that someday we're going to want to expand Sullivan Arena, or we're going to want to build a hockey rink someplace where a hockey rink just really needs to go. And we're going to find ourselves in a difficult position because we've, you know, in trying to keep bike paths out of my backyard, we've stopped a hockey rink for the good of, you know, thousands of kids in what is rapidly becoming, you know, an urban part of the state, which is, you know, my community and the community that Senator Huggins represents.
Senator, yes, sir, and I think that's probably one of the primary reasons that, you know, you are talking an instance that is, it is going to be unusual. I mean, you're thinking of something down the road that could possibly happen, and that's the reason that we have that number 7 in there, that out, that if something comes along that is that catch-all, end-all, you know, great project that's going to, you know, keep kids off the street and do things, that this body can affect that and say, this can be done. But as a blanket statement, we think that it is part of the policy that should be an extraordinary effort. That it shouldn't be just a, you know, well, we think it's good, and so we're going to do it. So it needs to go through that process.
And just to follow up, would the escape hatch that number 7 provides, that's for folks at home following along, it's page 4, line 9, would that escape hatch require a piece of legislation?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
So that is the attempt. That is the...
That's what you have in mind.
Yes,
okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, may I follow up? Craig, because that was one of the questions I had, not necessarily on the sports facility, but I am concerned about the small boat harbor, the definition of what a small boat harbor versus a large boat harbor is. A lot of those are run, and the state is now transferring those to local communities. And so how does that play into them needing to expand for a public purpose their boat harbor? And has that been thoroughly discussed on the record in past committees?
Senator, I think we found a lot of difficulty finding small boat harbors adjacent to private property with homes on it. Mm-hmm. If someone decides to build a home next to a small boat harbor, I would think that would be red flags, especially if this were in place. And possibly through zoning and other Corps of Engineer stuff would be prohibited from someone building a small home. I found difficulty finding a private home next to a small boat harbor. We do have Peter Putz here on the line, and who is with the department. You know, he is kind of an expert. He might be more able to answer that. But it is the definition is not. You know, have we clearly defined it? Probably not. Peter, maybe he's not.
I'm on the line.
Did you hear the question from Senator Guest, and can you address that at all regarding small boat harbors?
Yes, this is Peter Putz here from the Department of Law. I guess there are just a couple comments. First, small boat harbor has to be read in conjunction with A above, which means that the small boat harbor has to be the primary purpose has to be recreational before it would be barred under this section. The second thing to note is that before any case would be allowed, it would have to be for a public use as framed by the Constitution, Article 1, Section 18. You kind of have these boundaries or the container within which you would have to do your analysis of the small boat harbor. So there are some parameters on it. In terms of the technical question that was asked, which is small boat harbor specifically defined, or could we define it better? I suppose that could be done. It is open to some debate the way it is written right here, what it would encompass. But having said that, I also agree with Mr. Johnson's observation that we weren't able in crafting this to find a lot of examples where there are homes next to the small boat harbor. I'm not sure if that answered the question, but those are a few observations I would make about it.
If I may, Mr. Chair, a few follow-up questions. One, maybe I'm misreading the bill and being one of the non-attorneys in the Senate, but I don't see an and in there to say that it has to be A and B. Is that implied? I thought it was recreational facility or project means this and includes this, but that it could be, so it has to have a primary purpose for recreation and has to be one of these things? Is that what you were saying?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Guest, that you'd have to read the A and B together, that recreational facility or project means primary purpose has to be recreational, and then D is some instances of that. I think if there were a small boat harbor that were purely for non-recreational purposes, that would not be considered a recreational facility.
Can you remind the committee of where the definition in statute of recreational is?
Through the chair, Senator Guest, there's not a definition of recreational.
Okay. So, I don't know, Ock Bay Harbor here in Juneau, is that, some folks probably live on their boats down there, and some folks have probably commercial fishing boats, so it's not recreational, and some folks have their pleasure boats. Is, would that be a recreational harbor and a small boat harbor? It's fairly small.
I Madam Senator, I would think that is commercial. I wouldn't view that as purely recreational. And I think that's what we're looking at here, is a purely recreational. If you could find a commercial application to the boat harbor, I think it would be excluded from this bill.
We've gone through everybody. We're just talking through some.
Okay. Craig. Right. We can talk about that a little bit more, Craig. On that same line, we have playground, line 8. Just wanted to clarify something. If a playground's associated with a school, because most playgrounds are associated with a school, I'm guessing that's excluded. It's just not necessarily clear, and I wanted to make sure.
Madam Senator, there's nothing that would preclude a school from building a playground and taking private homes and everything else for building of that school.
For the building of that school. And as long as we're kind of on that section down on lines 14 and 15, a school program, I've seen school used a lot of different ways in statute and just didn't know what a school program is versus a route to a school as defined in the statute.
Peter, I can't answer this, but I think this is part of the federal law that requires safe trails to and from. Peter, did I misspeak there?
No, that's correct. One of the planners at the Department of Transportation informed me that there is a federal program in place, and this language was intended to track that federal program.
And that's a program that allows for pathways to and from schools and programs and stuff, so we wanted to make sure that was, we didn't get run afoul of the federal regulations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator French.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson, you probably told us this, but if you could just remind me, on page 5, lines 26, 27, and 28, there's a list of statutes that would that include takings that wouldn't be included in this bill. Could you just remind me what those are? Maybe Mr. Putzier knows.
Mr. Putzier, I think, could you answer that, please?
Yes. The Title 19 citations, 1905, 110, and 120 are takes that are done in association with road projects.
Road? Yes, sir, road. Thank you.
KS-1922-020 is landscaping and scenic enhancement within and adjacent to highways. AS-2721-300 is abandoned mine areas reclamation. AS-3520-040 and 050 are public buildings and public works. And AS-4135-060 are historic, prehistoric, and archaeological sites. None of these necessarily fall within the parameters of the definition of recreational, but we elected to include the specific citations basically out of an abundance of caution.
And if I could just follow up while we're on that topic, could you just explain what lines 29 and 30 mean?
Yes, lines 29 and 30 refer to Title 41 as parks, and within the park section, the legislature has already spoken in several instances and specifically excluded any takes for certain
did they talk about
park functions. And
yes.
So what this was intended to do is to be consistent with Title 41 as it's currently drafted, and the legislature has already apparently has analyzed when and under what circumstances eminent domain would be used pursuant to Title 41.
I almost have to restate that just to make sure I understand. You're saying that in an AS-4121, there are some prohibitions on eminent domain already on the books, and you're being careful here to not include them. I've got two negatives going here, so I've just got to work through it. It does not include a taking not prohibited. Right, so you're leaving open anything that statute leaves open, AS-4121. Anything that statute leaves open, you're leaving open for eminent domain. Is that right?
Through the chair, Senator French, that's correct. And there is an open question: what authority does exist under those circumstances where the legislature has arguably left the door open? It's not entirely clear cut. It's a difficult section to make your way through, and to my knowledge, the state has never exercised eminent domain pursuant to authorities under Section 41 or AS-4121.
Mr. Petzer, I'll probably ask our legal group for an opinion on that, just because I'm getting puzzled looks from the group that are here in the room. But thank you for your answer.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Craig, earlier we heard from Mr. Ritchie of local control, and it appears to me as a member that the reason we're here is because of local control at the lowest level, the property owner, and that, based on what had been traditional interpretations of eminent domain, that in some geographical areas of our country, that has been expanded greatly. And that's why we're sitting here today discussing this, because essentially property owners maybe have lost confidence in what the government may or may not do, and by virtue of that, they've lost local control. So now we have this multi-echelon approach. I think Congress is taking some action. We at the state are taking some action, and of course, Mr. Ritchie talked about what was transpiring at the local jurisdictions. When it comes to traditional trails, could you share with us what discussions you potentially had in other committees?
I'm not certain that I understand where you're going. Trails that are already in existence.
Right.
Probably would not be subject to nor need or require eminent domain.
Right.
So we really haven't had a lot of discussion about it for lack of it really entering into this picture. I think what we're talking about is future trails. We have protected access to and from state-owned
right-of-ways to traditional hunting and fishing areas, so we did protect that in this bill.
Right.
But in terms of existing trails, don't know that it comes into play unless someone wants to build a home on top of it, which I can't envision a way that could happen, although I don't have a crystal ball. So the discussion we didn't go very far about existing trails.
Yeah, I was just trying to get a feel for how much you fleshed that out. I think the guarantee for traditional trails under provisions are there, so it doesn't necessarily have to be addressed here.
Yeah, there are some incidences. I mean, I think there was a situation, I believe, in your district where the borough abandoned a right-of-way and someone built a home on it, and now they want to try to get the right-of-way back, and there's some difficulties there. And did the borough err in allowing someone to purchase that right-of-way or easement? And that's a discussion that will probably end up in court, not affected by this, although I can see where people would wrap that around the same axle. I don't think it's the same subject where the borough and the state are going to be at odds over relinquishing that property to a private person.
Yeah, and just as by way of a final comment, the proposition of bringing property rights to vote of the population in general makes me nervous. It just is a single individual. So I just go on record as an individual. I do not support that concept in the macro. Now, in the eaches, there may be some extenuating circumstances.
Senator Guess.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since Senator Tirio isn't with us today, I'll do what he would do, which is, do you really need the intent and finding section in the statute? It's a normal course of business that he normally asks that.
Madam Senator, and this question was asked in finance because we have people on our finance committee in the other body that have made it a sport of stripping intent language out of bills, and I think this is the first bill that they can remember passing out with intent language in a long, long time. The reason for this is contrary to most of the legislation that we look at in the two bodies, they're designed to keep people out of court. We pass ordinances to establish clear guidelines to keep people on the right side of the law so we don't have to go to court. This is a bill that by its very definition will be in court. Eminent domain is a court action. It goes back to clearly spelling out the intent. It was the view of the sponsor and the other body that we don't want a judge making decisions as to what our intent was. Therefore, this intent language was left in the bill to be part of the official documentation so that in the future people can read this and say, well, this is exactly what they meant. There is no gray area. This is what they wanted. This is how we move. So based upon that, it actually will be in court. 100% guaranteed at some time or another, eminent domain will have a court action. It by definition is court action. It was determined to leave the intent language in to clearly identify the intent of the legislature.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I have a couple questions. Give me an example of something that has taken place that would be covered on page 1 on lines 14 and 15. Attach a name and a face to something for me, if you would. Give me an example of where that has been used and where the problem that we're trying to solve.
Well, you could, Mr. Chairman, I think that you probably wouldn't have to go very much further than the Coastal Trail in Anchorage to see it. You've heard testimony that the original Coastal Trail took some property and everyone screamed about it and everyone was very happy about it, and now it's the most wonderful thing in the world except to those homeowners who had their homes taken. I bet you'd have a difficult time finding them jumping up and down about losing their homes. So I think that would be an example of a recreational facility under this definition that had been taken. There are hypotheticals this legislation, I want to be clear, was not designed to do anything to the Coastal Trail in Anchorage specifically. As had been stated in testimony earlier, the Anchorage Assembly has already taken care of that problem.
I would think that a trail, if someone wanted to potentially build a motocross area in a, you know, for motorcycles and stuff in an area with homes, that would be prohibited. Specifically, there hasn't been a lot of that in Alaska. We are looking at the future, and once again, that big policy of protecting someone's home.
Senator French?
Chairman, thank you. Mr. Johnson, as far as the Coastal Trail example goes, I'm fairly certain that some edges of lots were taken, but I am, and maybe you can correct me, but I am entirely unaware of someone's home being knocked down to make way for that trail.
Senator French, I am not certain of the, I was not involved in the South Anchorage Coastal Trail. I know in the current Coastal Trail, I don't think there are any homes that are going to be taken either, in terms of their complete physical in any of the plans that I've seen for the current Coastal Trail. It's a quality of life, and is the home going to be knocked down? And that's why we defined it as, had you rather have your home knocked down or have a snow machine trail 3 feet from your bedroom window? So, you know, that's why the distance and the buffer zone was created and the thought process that went behind that as well. There's a point where losing it is, you may not lose it, but you also might deteriorate its value and the quality of life.
So when Senator Seekins asked for an example of the taking of a landowner's personal residence, you took that to mean property within 250 feet of a house?
Yes, sir. As defined, and that's why it's qualified as defined by this bill.
I see. And if it developed that all those homes were more than 250 feet away from the Coastal Trail as it runs through my district, then you'd have to concede that that's not a good example.
Certainly, yes, sir.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
And I'll go back to my original statement. I don't know that I could come up with a specific example. But as things, as we start forcing more and more people into that 1% of property that we own, I think it would be a great way for us to look at forcing the recreational opportunities outside of that 1%.
Mr. Chair?
Senator, yes.
Thank you. Okay, then now I need to clarify something from the last hearing to this hearing that we talked about. Is the 250 feet, I have 4.5 acres, and so you know, that's the football field example of around my property, and you can't go within that, or I have a 10,000 foot lot, but you can't go 250 linear feet from that. I thought it ended at my property lot, and I guess I'm need another picture. I'm confused the last and the last conversation we had last time and this one, because I thought I understood it's only if you own that property, you can't control 250 feet from your home.
You are correct, and okay. and that is and the way we got the 250 feet was just like you did. I took basic high school geometry and pi r squared, 250 feet, went to a website.
House in the middle, 250, draw a circle around it.
Went to a website that square feet and pushed it in, and it said it was about 4 acres.
Okay, let's take a look at that. Let's look at it. I've never seen a round lot. Most of them are some kind of square.
I knew a guy lived in a round house.
Yeah.
He was a different guy.
I've never seen a round lot. 2.5 acres is 330 feet square. If the house is built in the middle of the property, you can't take any of the land on that 2.5 acres.
That would be correct, sir.
Okay. So, you know, if you're looking at 5 acres, you're looking at about 660 feet.
Roughly, yes, sir.
So, you're, not really. It depends on how you make it. 660 by 330. Let's make it that way.
Yes, sir.
If we make it square, we'd have to change that. But, well, I could still do that from my high school geometry.
See, I had to have the website, sir. You're better than I.
I'm a pretty good geometry teacher, boy, I'll tell you what. But it's, so then if the house is built in that 660 by 330, it's in the middle of that. It's 330 feet from one end to the other. They could take property as long as it's not within 250 feet of my house.
That would be correct, sir.
Okay.
And that, once again, go back to that balance that we struck. There are people like, and you missed I think you weren't here for the testimony that the last 2 days in Anchorage, the conservative talk shows are blasting this bill because we are at 250 feet, not 1,000 or 2,000 or 3,000 or any property at all. So we're taking heat from the people that don't want the 250 feet to be there, want it to be much larger than that. I'm sure you've all received your 318 fan mail as well. It is a balance, and that's the number we came. And there's nothing magic about it, as I testified to earlier. If it's 300, it's 300. If it's there's a point where 100 feet may be too small to actually protect someone's quality of life, or 50 feet may be too small to protect someone's quality of life. But that's a balance, and that's open for negotiation and discussion, sir.
So let's move out to Charlie's district, where there's a lot of lakes. Nobody would ever really be able to build a bike path around that lake unless all the houses were at least 250 feet plus the width of the bike path back from the surface of the lake. Is that correct?
Yes, sir, that would be correct.
Is that enough distance for your boys out there, Charlie?
I can't speak for all of them.
I suspect that Senator Huggins might be one of those people that might fall in the 1,000-foot category with some of his constituents out there, sir.
But access to navigable streams, even if it might be called purely, or that navigable water, state-owned waterway, even if it's called purely recreational, all they want to do is have a boat launch there to be able to go water skiing, but they want access to that navigable water. That's allowed?
Yes, sir.
But we might not be able to build the boat ramp.
That might be the case, sir.
That's a dichotomy that I don't quite understand.
If you could find a commercial application for that boat ramp, you could probably get...
Or if one person wants to go fishing, that's not recreational?
If only one person, and that's the only one, and there's no other opportunity, no commercial opportunity, probably, sir, yes, sir.
Because as I understand, settled law in the state of Alaska, that it's a right of the people to be able to go fishing.
To have access, yes, sir.
Even to go fishing under Totemoff.
Yes, sir. But is it the right of them to take someone's home to launch their boat to go fishing?
No, but every navigable water has to have access. And I look at the bill, and I see that you're saying that, but at the same time, on the boat ramp issue, we're saying have to have access, but you might not be able to have a ramp there to launch the boat to be able to have access.
Senator Stevens, I will confess that past administrations may have made mistakes in selling state land to private owners along navigable waterways, that this bill may prohibit actually building a road and a boat launch to because someone has a home there. I would think that in the future we would look very hard at any private land that we are land that we transfer to private individuals and prohibit that, so we guarantee that access.
If there's anything in this bill that prohibits being able to access navigable waters, I can't vote for it.
The definition of access, I think, there is nothing that will prohibit the access to navigable waters in this bill. There's a specific language that allows it. Is it okay to build a big road for a boat launch? Access there is. This bill does not prohibit access. Whether it's a full-fledged road, that there are areas where that wouldn't be appropriate and areas where it would. I think if...
See, under state law now,
as
I understand state law now, when the state disposes of land, they're supposed to provide easement for access every so many feet. You know how far that part that is?
I do not. Mr. Putzier, do you know the distance that is required for access to public waterways?
I do not.
Did you hear the question about access to navigable waters? I think this bill covers that, and the DNR amendment that we put in certainly covers that, but I don't know about the boat launch and the road to and from. Could you address that briefly for the senator?
On that issue, I'd have to defer to Department of Natural Resources. I'm not sure if John Baker is on the line today or not. I didn't hear him on the initial introduction. He had originally intended to try and attend today.
I don't see him.
Would that be a question I need to pose to our DNR attorney?
I think Mr. Menefee was on. Wynn, are you still on?
This is Wynn Menefee from DNR, and I am still on. I was just looking at 3805-127, which is the statute addressing access to navigable public waters, and when we do sell, lease, or grant, or dispose of interest in state land adjacent to a body of water, that we do look at the access, and oftentimes what we do is we put a 50 feet access easement along navigable water bodies, but I don't believe that I have a measurement between, when you're talking about trying to get to a water body, how many feet till you put another access to it. What we typically do is we reserve along the water body access, and of course you have to get to that to start with.
I have to check that, because it seems to me that there is a provision in law that when we dispose of land, we have, and it's adjacent to a navigable waterway, that we have to preserve reasonable access within so many feet, and that's fine as long as people know that it's there. There's no question; they understand what the requirements are. It'd be a real problem for me if I say the people own the water but they can't get to it.
Senator Deacon, this is a Whitman again. I do have an answer for you on that.
Okay.
Just read a little further in that same statute, and under F, it says right-of-ways or easement to waterways established under A2 shall be established approximately once each mile.
Okay. So you could assume that to a lake, there should be at least one?
Correct.
Okay. Any other questions on that? Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Wynn, isn't there also some provision for public use along the shoreways of the lake?
If it's determined to be navigable public water, then we would, as we dispose of it, we would put the easement, which is, we call it to and along, which is a 50-foot easement along the waterway.
But, Wynn, if I understand, excuse me, Kelly, yeah, did you have a question? Well, if I understand the law, parcels that were already deeded over may not have that easement.
There are some instances where the state has transferred land and does not have that on there. We don't have a provision within this to go back and create it once we've disposed of it, but we are supposed to put it on there.
Right.
And so I do know you're absolutely correct that there are some that have gone out that did not have that put on.
So if there was a lake or a stream that didn't have any access to it, reasonable access to it, there wasn't an easement that was reserved when it was transferred from state land. Maybe it was prior to state ownership of the land. Maybe it was a federal patent, or however it was transferred, a homestead. The riparian landowner may not have a two-and-along easement that exists at this particular time. Is that correct?
That is correct. There are speculative, like you mentioned, on the federal transfers that before the state took ownership or something like that, where the land was transferred to a private owner and there is no easement. So we have many breaks in that. We could very well have an easement going along a stream, hit a U.S. survey, there'll be no easement, and then it'll pick up again on the other side.
Okay, and on the easements that are provided now in current statute, what's the size of that easement? What's the width of it? Does it specify?
50 feet is what I believe we put on there. I don't actually see the width immediately in the statute. I apologize for that. But I believe it's 50.
So if you were going to put an easement to a navigable waterway and you wanted to have some kind of a facility there to be able to launch a boat and park a car, would you be able to fit that in a 50-foot easement?
It depends on your borough requirements and things like that. 50 feet typically is enough to get by vehicle to a
have to use eminent domain to be able to acquire land to be able to get access to that navigable water?
You would be able to get access. It depends on, like I said, it depends on what you want to do. For instance, could you walk down it? Could you travel across it with like an ATV or something? That seems to be very well within the realm of the statute. Can you actually put a paved road on it? Becomes a question that oftentimes is brought up against us inserting the access onto an along easement.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, if you'd look at the bill on page 5, line 31, where the exceptions, this was an amendment put in at the request of Department of Natural Resources, which basically says a path, road, or trail, this is an exemption, that so eminent domain can be used for this. A path, trail, road, or site for which no reasonable alternative exists and which is necessary to preserve and establish public access to or along a publicly owned land, water, if the use of the path, trail, road itself is for transportation to and from the facility and not used for recreation itself. So you could build a road, but I guess you couldn't take a picture as you go through the road, so you couldn't stop and have a picnic. But the ability to build a trail to those navigable waters is addressed in this legislation. It clearly allows for that.
Other questions? I've got to take a look at that. I get worried about the definition of recreation.
And that's quite appropriate. And I think the committee process hopefully will flush out those definitions and strengthen them.
I know I argue with the Department of Fish and Game. They call me a sport fisherman. And I'm more of a fillet and release guy. See?
I too have a freezer full that I depend on. So
if I'm not taking it home, is that recreation? So I have to ask that question because I do believe that there's a fundamental right of the people to have access to their property, reasonable access, and I see that. But if once I got there, I didn't have the right to be able to have some kind of a boat ramp to be able to do that, I might have a question. So I'm not trying to be argumentative, but I would like to eliminate arguments before they begin.
Mr. Chairman, and I think you were presenting a bill at the time when I said this, but it is the goal of the sponsor not to affect except those two very narrow uses of eminent domain, and that's private-to-private transfer and protecting someone's home. Along a lot of these waterways, there is no home. I could see insidious people who wanted to prevent access building a home. We also covered that in this bill, that you can't do it specifically to circumvent eminent domain. Your concerns are founded. There's no doubt about it. They are very reasonable and would love to address them.
Did you, while I was gone, discuss trust property?
No, sir, we didn't. But I did bring to your staff, the short answer is it's not protected. One of the things you give up with a trust is control. We did have some language drafted and looked at and approved through several sources that could do that, and it's certainly not inappropriate to introduce that as an amendment to protect trust land. It actually is a very simple amendment. I think your staff may have that.
I have it. I just wanted to know if you discussed it.
We didn't discuss it, no, sir.
And I'll discuss that with you afterwards a little bit too. But because I think that is a legitimate concern. There are family trusts that own the family whole homestead, and mom and dad still live there. And it's simply an estate mechanism as much as it is anything else, but it certainly to me is personal ownership.
And that's certainly appropriate, sir.
Yeah. Okay, other questions for today? We appreciate everybody's being with us today and giving public testimony. We've got, if you have suggested amendments or changes, would you please bring them to my attention so that we can take a look at them? And we will bring this bill back up in the near future and try to get it out of committee and take a look at any amendments that people have or suggestions. And we'll, with that, it's now
15 minutes after the hour of 10 a.m., and we're going to adjourn for the day.
Thank you, sir.